From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, I speak with writer Ved Mehta. He's chronicling his life in a series of autobiographies. The installments already published cover his youth in India, losing his sight at age 4, and his coming of age in America. Also today, novelist and short story writer Lori Colwin talks with us about home cooking, the subject of her new collection of essays. And we have reviews of the new album from the rock group Fishbone and of David Cronenberg's new film, Dead Ringers. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Ved Mehta is finishing up the 7th volume of a series of autobiographical books, which he began in 1972. He once referred to writing this continuing autobiography as rather like being an archaeologist of oneself, although Mehta's books explore many turning points of childhood, adolescence, and adulthood, which we all can identify with, his personal story is quite uncommon. Ved Mehta grew up in India. A case of meningitis left him blind at the age of 4. At 15, he came to the United States to study at a school for the blind in Arkansas. Initially, he was very disoriented in America, way out of the mainstream by virtue of being both blind and Indian. He eventually settled in New York, where he now lives with his wife and child. Norton Books is publishing the whole series of Mehta's autobiographies in paperback. Mama G came out last month, and Daddy G will be published in November. The 7th volume, about his college years, will come out in February. Ved Mehta has written 10 other books, including Portrait of India and a biography of Mahatma Gandhi. Ved Mehta once wrote, "I sometimes feel I am leading two lives, the life that I am remembering and interpreting, and my ordinary day-to-day life." I asked him if his current life is always affected by the one that he's writing about.
Of course, because writing life is very much part of my real life. In other words, I spend 8-10 hours a day either writing or thinking about writing or worrying about writing. So obviously, in a sense, I'm always leading a double life, a life I'm remembering and documenting and reading over. When I set about the task of reconstructing my life, I usually go back to journals, to letters of the period, to land deeds, to account books, registers, whatever, anything that will jog my memory and will bring that period into focus. So in a sense, I'm living in the past and present at the same time. By the way, I think that's much more normal in most people's lives that they probably know. I think all memory, by definition, is current. We only remember those things that have some bearing on our present life. I think the memory of real events probably doesn't exist as real events, if you see what I mean.
You've been blind since the age of 4, and I wonder if you remember sight at all, and if you have any memories of it that you feel help you in your writing or in your reading of other books.
Well, in conscious memory, I have no memory, because all conscious memory, by definition, depends on reinforcement. And, of course, I've had no reinforcement since I was 4. But surely in my unconscious, those memories must be there. If Freud is to be believed, the earliest years are the most determining years. And surely, somewhere in my head, all those memories are there. I do believe that Freud is right, that nothing that happens to us from the moment we separate from mother's body, from our mother's body, is lost. It's all there. So that's really all I can say about it. But I have no conscious evidence to which I can point.
Well, you know, I almost feel, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but I almost feel like I know you intimately from having read some of your work, because you're so frank about what you experienced?
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that, but I should just warn you that writers have many personae.
Right.
Personae is a Latin word for mask, if I can be pedantic. And so we wear many masks. And of course, no matter how much we tell, there's always more to tell. And in a sense, by the very act of writing a book, you outgrow that self. And so it's a constant process of, as it were, changing skins. I do think that, although I don't set out to write confessions or anything like that, the attempt is to be as truthful, painful though it is, as I can possibly be, because otherwise I think there is really no reason to write autobiography. But I do have to say that no matter how truthful you are and how careful one is to be accurate, of course this is life reconstructed, like, or it's a literary life, and it's not the real life. I should just make one other point, that which I started out with, that though it deals with memory, it's current memory, but I think there is something that I'm doing that's unusual. At least I don't know anybody else who's done it. Let me give you an example. I start to write Vedi, which covers really the period of my life from age 5 to 8. When I started writing it, I had no idea whether it would be a chapter in a book or a paragraph in a book, because when I asked myself, what do I remember between age 5 and 8? The answer was, well, not very much. But then I started asking myself, when I would sit down at my desk to write, now, wait a minute, where were you during those years? So how did you get there? Who did you know? Who did you care about? Do you remember any people? What were they doing? How did they affect you, or how did you relate to them? And through a process of association, a paragraph grew into a page into a chapter, and chapter eventually into a book. But here is what I'm talking about, doing something different. In addition to trying to remember, I also go, whenever it's possible, and interview the people whom I knew at the time.
I'd like to talk with you a little bit about your early life. After you went blind, your mother took you to several faith healers because she believed that you had a chance of regaining your sight. Was that a frightening experience to go to these faith healers? And did you think you'd ever get it back?
Well, I think that a denial mechanism is very strong in human psychology. We all try to deny unpleasant facts in every day of our lives. If you were to ask yourself the question, well, supposing if I were an ugly person, I would try to deny that I'm an ugly person because it would make life very difficult. That's the most obvious example. Now, here was a well-to-do family. I came from a well-to-do family in Indian terms, not by American terms. And blindness was an affliction which wasn't supposed to strike anybody who was well-to-do. It really was something associated with the poor, like leprosy. And I was one of seven children, and suddenly I lost my sight. At that time, I was one of six, and I'd lost my sight. Now, my mother was not a very educated person, and she was also a believer. We have instances of very educated believer who believe, among, say, Catholics, there are certain relics in which they believe, or certain places, if you go, you might be healed. So she was taken in hand, or she allowed herself to be taken in hand by faith healers and quacks and charlatans of all kinds, whether they themselves believed that they had power to heal. Or maybe they didn't, but they were just trying to take advantage of her, I don't know. But, of course, my identification with my mother was so strong that if she believed that these horrible medicines that were put in my eyes, or certain birch sticks that I was beaten with, would cure me of the demons which had got into my brain and seized my optic nerve, and not that they would know optic nerve, but had taken away my sight, well, then I believed along with her. At the same time, I had a contrary influence in my father, who was actually a a medical man, he was trained in the West, in Western medicine, who didn't have any faith because he knew that as a result of meningitis, my optic nerves had been damaged and there was no way to restore them. So these healers were consulted behind his back, but when he did find out about them, he would tell me, "This is all nonsense. You have to make your life accepting the fact that you'll never be able to see, at least never be able to see insofar as we now know through modern medicine." So I was really torn between my mother's point of view and my father's, and there was times when I took my mother's side, other times when I took my father's.
Your father sent you to a school for the blind that was around 1,300 miles away from your home when you were 5 years old. And I think part of the reason why he did that is he wanted to make sure that you learned how to survive on your own. And I think he had visions of all the blind beggars in the streets of India and, you know, didn't want you ever to become that. Is that something that you ever worried about yourself, that if you didn't become self-sufficient, that was the alternative?
Yes, I absolutely did, because that was the only fate or lot of the blind people in India. India is such a poor country that there's so many people who just slip off the escalator of life and never get back on it.
Your father also suggested to you that at some point you should go to the West, you should go to America, because no Indian parents of your class and of your education would ever give their daughter to you in marriage.
Yes, well, he had been educated in England and America, and although he had vision of the blind beggars in India, he also knew that in the West there was another perspective on blindness, where someone like Roosevelt, who was paralyzed, could become the president. And so he took a a very Western outlook toward my handicap, and which is what we called it then. And I think I identified with him, and that became a kind of propelling impulse in my own life, that I myself wanted to get out of India and get to the West and see the and see my blindness from a different perspective.
And I guess you also really wanted to excel and achieve so that you could become self-sufficient.
That's right. I think that's a goal of anybody, blind or not, to become independent and self-sufficient and effective citizens in their own right. But of course, if you are blind or paralyzed, the struggle becomes that much harder.
After you finished your education in India, you came to America and studied first at a school for the blind in Arkansas. And this happened at a time when you were a young man, so you were reaching manhood in a new country. Did it take you a long time to figure out the American conception of manhood?
Well, I was 15 when I came here. I don't know if I could have put it that way. I mostly saw it in these incredible terms of dating and going steady, all these terms, and the music. So that was the first experience I had of American life. For instance, I never knew there was such thing as divorce in the world. So all these were new experiences, and they had powerful effect, because at the same time I was having these powerful adolescent emotions of wanting to connect with somebody else, of wanting somebody to talk to, because although I'd been 1,300 miles away from India when I was between 5 and 8, but now I was 10,000 miles away, and there was no communication, really, verbal communication possible between anyone at home and Arkansas, and the two worlds were so different.
You must have really felt like an outsider, even when you were in a blind school, and being blind didn't set you apart from people. Being Indian must have. I'm sure you were.
I think I was the only Indian in Arkansas.
Yeah, right.
Right, of course. But at the same time, like all adolescents, I wanted to belong. And so while I internally felt outsider, outwardly I was trying to adjust and adapt and become just another Arkansas boy. I mean, that was my great aim.
In a couple of your books, you write about something called facial vision, and of something that you describe as sound shadows, ways in which people without sight can sense what's around them.
Right.
Could you describe a little bit what that is?
Yeah, it's really a system of echoes. It's no different. We have a country house in Maine, and I noticed that sailors there, when it's very foggy, blow a whistle, and they can tell by the sound of the whistle bouncing off rocks where exactly they are. It's the same system that blind people use when you're, say, walking along this, clicking along the street. You can tell by the clicks whether you're near a wall or open space or coming up against a mailbox. I describe that in the book. I can't do it very briefly here, but basically it's trying to see the world through your ears, and that's how most of us avoid obstacles and learn to get around in streets, you know, travel by ourselves.
Did going to schools for the blind help you develop that sense?
Yes, because obviously somebody who understands the system and is expert, they are much better at training. In fact, I would say the best thing I got out of the school in Arkansas was learning what they call mobility. I already had facial vision. I used to ride a bicycle and so on. I couldn't have known what you called it. I just knew that if I were on a bicycle and coming very fast towards a lamppost or something, I could tell that I was approaching something. I couldn't tell what it was. But at this school, they helped me perfect it and gave me a conceptual framework, which then allowed me to move about streets and different states by myself.
I think when you started going to a mainstream school, Pomona College, that a lot of your fellow students wouldn't let you rely on your own sense.
Yeah, only in the beginning. I think when they first saw me going around, they couldn't imagine that I could just step off the curve and I would know when to get there or go up the stairs or run down a flight of stairs. But after I'd been there for a week or so, then everybody left me alone. But they couldn't. They always wondered how I did it. But certainly they got used to me and after a while just accepted me as one of them. I was in California, for 4 years? And I think after the first week or two or three, I was just taken as a normal student.
You always wanted to make sure that you could get around yourself without relying on a cane or a dog, and you've certainly been able to do that. But I wonder if it's gotten any harder in the past few years as cities have gotten more dangerous?
Oh, yes, it is. It is harder. For instance, Manhattan, where I live now, resembles a mining town. I used to walk home from my office on 43rd Street. I used to live on 82nd and 5th. And I would walk home in the evening just to get some exercise. And now I would be afraid to walk 2-3 blocks because there are scaffoldings, there are construction everywhere. There are machinery of one kind or another. So yes, it's become harder, but manageable.
Do you get around by yourself?
Yes, of course.
Yeah. I want to talk with you more.
By the way, different blind people have different degree of facial vision. It's like anything else in life. I happen to be endowed with perhaps more sensitivity than some other blind people, some people who become blind late in life have to use dogs, whereas I never needed to. But I'm glad that dogs are available for those who need them.
My guest is writer Ved Mehta, and his series of autobiographies is being released in paperback by Norton. The latest one to be published is called Vedi. We're going to talk some more after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
The last installment of your autobiography covers the period of your life where you went to Pomona College. What kind of research did you do to remember that?
Well, you know, because I was separated from my family by thousands of miles, I wrote them letter practically every week. And I have all those, they saved those letters. They wrote me letters. Then I was writing term papers. Then I kept a journal. It was not a daily journal, but infrequent journal. Then I went back to Pomona and met some of the people and interviewed them. And the procedure was no different than the procedure I followed writing other volumes. The section you read in The New Yorker is a small section of a big book I'm doing on my college years in California.
It seems to me you've always been an outsider in your world since your parents sent you to the School for the Blind at age 4. Been an outsider by virtue either of being blind or of being Indian while you were in America. Of course, you always ended up working your way in and becoming a part of things, but you'd always start as a real outsider. Now, I think all adolescents feel like outsiders, but in you it must have been so heightened. And I wonder if you think that that helped you in any way as a writer, since what writers do is stay on the outside and observe.
I think all artists are outsiders. There was a popular book written by Colin Wilson in the 50s called The Outsider, where he argued that all artists are outsiders. I don't know if I go that far. I don't know if Chaucer was an outsider, but or Shakespeare. But there's no question that in order to observe life, it helps you to be both an outsider and perhaps also to be insider. In other words, you always have little different perspective. If your perspective was the same as everybody else's, there'd be no point in writing anything or drawing a picture. There's something that sets us apart, and no matter how much insider I become, my mental life will always be that of an outsider.
No, I think sometimes we like to think that people who've lost one sense are compensated by having another sense that's heightened, and I'm sure some people have asked you if you felt that your blindness has been compensated with your gift of perception, your gift as a writer. Have you thought about that at all?
Well, I've obviously thought about it, but I don't think it has been. I think the only compensation I've got is intelligence and hard work. But no, I don't think that there are many people who see, who hear just as well, if not better, who have perfect pitch, which I don't have. I don't think my fingers are any more sensitive than those of a typist who comes to me. No, I think my perceptions are pretty ordinary. My senses, but when it comes to my intellectual perceptions, they are heightened. But there are a lot of seeing people who have terrific intellectual perceptions. I don't think that has much to do with blindness.
Is this a romantic vision that you think people who are sighted have?
No, I think people like to console themselves if they see somebody who's walking along who can't see. They may feel sorry, but then if they can say to themselves, oh, but maybe he has great perception of hearing or something, it makes them feel better. But there's no psychological evidence for any of that. It's popular myth.
You have a position that many, many writers would envy. You're a staff writer for The New Yorker, and I think that's correct. You're a staff writer?
Well, yes, I don't know what that means exactly. Basically, I'm a freelance writer who has a contract with The New Yorker to show them my things before I show them to anybody else. But it's a very loose arrangement. And so, I pretty much write what I want to and hope they will accept some of it.
You've been writing for The New Yorker since 1961.
Well, I've been staff writer. I think my first piece appeared for them in 1959. That's right.
Did you ever worry that if you hadn't had that base and if your credentials as a writer hadn't already been established, that it might have been hard to get your autobiographies published?
Oh, absolutely. It's already hard. I think we are now coming into an age when everything is the marketplace, and the kind of writing I do is so specialized and so much depends on formal prose and reading carefully. That kind of reading television has destroyed. People now, even editors, read, and they don't read the way I read. They just skim over something. They get an idea, and basically what they're looking for, is this a marketable subject? So, oh sure, some of my autobiographical volumes had to be published by Oxford University Press because I couldn't get commercial publishers to publish them. And now they are being reestablished in paperback by a commercial house, which I'm delighted about.
You spend so much of your time remembering your past so that you could piece it together for the series of autobiographies that you're writing. And I think for a lot of us, there's something liberating to forget our past, because by forgetting your past, you forget about all the mistakes that you made, all the stupid things that you've said, all the pain that you've experienced. Do you ever wish that you didn't have to do all that remembering for your work?
No, because I think that people who live without sense of past are no better than animals. They might as well be dogs, as far as I'm concerned. I think what makes a human being different from all the animals is obviously speech, but more importantly, it's the memories. It's the history of their own lives. And people, they may say they're trying to forget it, but I think it determines your life. You may forget it, but your unconscious doesn't, and that determines your conduct all the time.
Ved Mehta, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Ved Mehta writes for The New Yorker magazine. His autobiographical book, Mama G, has just come out in paperback, and Daddy G will be published in November by Norton Books. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with comic Richard Belzer. He gained a reputation as one of the most aggressive comics around. After giving up drugs and surviving cancer, Belzer has calmed down, but he's still known for his biting social commentary. He's now appearing in the film Freeway, and he has a new book out called How to Be a Stand-Up Comic. This will be Belzer's second visit to Fresh Air. Here's an excerpt from our first interview.
When I was a teenager, and we started first getting into Bob Dylan, and we found out his real name is Zimmerman, and he's a Jew from Minnesota, and this was like a revelation to have a hero that's a Jew. So I said, if his name is Zimmerman, he must have had a bar mitzvah. So I fantasized what Bob Dylan's bar mitzvah must have been like, you know. Baruch atah Eloheinu melech olam. And then when he gets older, you know, oi, once upon a time, you dress so fine, you threw the bums a dime in your prime, didn't you? People called Shady Red Doll, you're bound to fall, you thought they was all kidding you.
Time you dress so fine, threw the bumps of dime in your prime, didn't you? People call, say beware doll, you're bound to fall, you thought they were all kidding you. You used to laugh about everybody that was hanging out. So loud. Now you don't seem so proud about having to be scrounging your next meal. How does it feel? How does it feel to be without? But you know you only used to get juiced in it. Nobody's ever taught you how to live out on the street, and now you're gonna have to get used to it. You say you never compromise with the mystery tramp, but now you realize he's not selling it.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When novelist Lori Colwyn decided to try her hand at nonfiction, she wrote about the one subject she really knew, frying chicken. Coming up, Lori Colwyn talks about her new collection of essays on the joys of home cooking. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new album from Fishbone, a black rock band with a political edge and musical influences as diverse as Jimi Hendrix and Steely Dan. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Dead Ringers, David Cronenberg's psycho thriller about identical twin gynecologists. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. A former Mexican policeman was found guilty in Los Angeles today of the 1985 torture murder of U.S. drug agent Enrique Camarena. Raul Lopez Alvarez is the first of three alleged members of a Mexican drug ring to be convicted in the case. Camarena was abducted from Guadalajara in 1985. His battered body and that of his pilot were found several weeks later. A federal jury is still deliberating the fate of two co-defendants. The House today approved by a vote of 375 to 30 a tough new anti-drug bill that would punish both small-time and major drug peddlers and provide for rehabilitation of drug abusers. The $2 billion legislation also contains a provision requiring the death penalty for certain drug-related murders. Before the final vote, the House amended the bill to give states additional highway money if they revoke driving privileges of convicted drug offenders. The Senate has not yet begun consideration of its own anti-drug bill. Protest strikes spread in Soviet Armenia today as authorities sent troops and armored vehicles into the area to try to restore order. The strikes began after a new round of violence last weekend in the ethnic conflict between Armenian and the neighboring Soviet Republic of Azerbaijan. Details from NPR's Ann Cooper.
Strikers in the Armenian capital of Yerevan vowed to continue their protest tomorrow, despite the deployment of troops. A resident reached by telephone said some protesters plan to spend the night in Yerevan's Opera Square to prevent troops from barricading their usual gathering place. The TASS news agency said the Armenian strikes have spread to four other districts in the republic, and in Stepanakert, capital of the territory of Nagorno-Karabakh, workers stayed off the job for the 11th straight day. The ethnic unrest began last February with Nagorno-Karabakh's demand to be removed from Azerbaijani jurisdiction and united with Armenia. There were no new reports of violence today, but the vows to continue protesting are a direct challenge to Moscow's efforts to get the Armenians back to work. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
Secretary of State George Shultz and Soviet Foreign Minister Shevardnadze are holding what could be their last round of full-scale meetings. During the formal talks today, they took time out to praise each other. NPR's Ann Garrels reports.
In a toast at a State Department luncheon, Shultz expressed his high personal esteem for Shevardnadze, calling him one of the most thoughtful men of our time. Shevardnadze responded by saying his 28 meetings with Shultz have resulted in one of the most dynamic and impressive periods in the history of U.S.-Soviet relations. "I like to believe," said Shevardnadze, "that you and I have been good builders of bridges." Though there's less than 2 months before the U.S. presidential elections, Shevardnadze said he came here with lots of proposals ready to do business, particularly on arms control. Business was interrupted when an Armenian protester, seeking to visit his dying mother in Armenia, threw himself in front of Shevardnadze's car. The limousine screeched to a halt. Shevardnadze got out and spoke to the 61-year-old man. Later, Shevardnadze said he would look into the matter. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
A Western diplomat in Haiti today said the continuing military rebellion has pushed the impoverished nation to the brink of anarchy. There are reports more soldiers have mutinied against their commanders, and civilian mobs have reportedly slaughtered 12 members of the Tonton Macoutes, the brutal secret police force formed by the deposed Duvalier dictatorship. 20 deaths have been reported since General Prosper Avril led the weekend coup that toppled President Henri Nomfi. Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 10 points to close at 2080.01. Advances led declines 8-5 on volume of 152 million shares. You're listening to NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The rock band Fishbone has been delivering hard-hitting social commentaries ever since their 1985 debut release, Party at Ground Zero. As the title suggests, they also have an irreverent sense of humor. The first tour was called Bone in the USA. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of Fishbone's new album, Truth and Soul. There once was a mob that wanted her. There once was a pod that wanted her.
As I listened to Truth and Soul, I realized that the influences I was hearing in the music weren't musical ones. The sensibility of this black rock band is like the pop equivalent of filmmaker Spike Lee, combined with the literary impudence of the novelist Ishmael Reed. Like Lee and Reed, Fishbone takes the pop cultural cliches that blacks are forced into and tries to exaggerate those stereotypes, to stretch them until they snap. On No Cut is this pointed satirical strategy made more clear than on a song called Slow Bus Movin' Howard Beach Party. This tune takes the racial nightmare of the Howard Beach incident, in which a group of young black men were chased down and assaulted by a group of whites in New York. Fishbone links that up with icy irony to 60s civil rights figures such as Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. To add to the song's layered complexity, all of this is sung by Angelo Moore in a voice that always seems on the verge of breaking into an Eddie Murphy impersonation.
Born in the 1940s, my parents couldn't hold on. Etsy King was on a march for power, true.
Black power, that is. Panthers and their attitudes were fast. New business suits. Dance, dance, dance.
Stricken with determination to rise above a slave. The male men used fire horses to spray the monkeys back in their cages. To spray the monkeys back in their cages.
As for the music Fishbone makes, it's all over the map. Punk rock's thrash and bellow, rap's conversational vocals, heavy metal's brutal volume, all of it figures in Fishbone's music. They call themselves the Coalition Against Tradition, and Fishbone is drawn to other eclectic artists, from George Clinton's Parliament Funkadelic to Frank Zappa's Kurt Weirdness. In an especially clever gesture, Fishbone takes the Curtis Mayfield oldie Freddy's Dead and turns it into an unclassifiable piece of soulful rock. This choice is a significant one. Freddy's Dead, as you may remember, was written for the soundtrack of Superfly, the first and ultimate black exploitation picture of the 60s. The song is an excellent piece of music by itself, but it also carries with it the sort of black cultural context that Fishbone likes to play off of.
Freddy's dead. That's what I said.
Fishbone is getting some unexpected exposure just now from an unlikely source. On A Vision Shared, the Woody Guthrie Lead Belly Benefit album I reviewed a couple of weeks ago, Fishbone backs Little Richard in a raucous version of Rock Island Line. That performance makes a specific link with Little Richard, whose culture-crossing form of rock, rhythm and blues, and pop anarchy is a model for Fishbone's own work.
Rock on the line.
like a lot of original pop music, Fishbone's very eclecticism works against the band in a commercial sense. They're bound to be treated like a novelty act. This is what's happening right now, for example, to Bobby McFerrin, whose song Don't Worry, Be Happy is currently the number one song in the country. McFerrin performs a cappella, mixing up jazz and pop and soul, yet Don't Worry, Be Happy is a song without a context. It's a novelty hit, and one whose success McFerrin will be hard-pressed to repeat, even though he has more talent than any 10 acts that sell millions of records. In a very similar way, Fishbone's leaping, screaming live shows have made them very popular in music clubs and in colleges, but to a great extent, it's the sort of attention that can be merely curious and fleeting, and Fishbone deserves better than that.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. From Truth and Soul, here's the song, Changes.
There's a light on a hill that's far out in the distance, and it calls out my name. It calls out for a change. Faraway voices that want their own choices. Sigh for a plea as it calls out for a change. Ooh, change.
This is Fresh Air. Laurie Colwyn's novels and short stories, she tells us about her characters through the objects they surround themselves with, dishes, furnishings, clothing. In her new book, Home Cooking, Colwyn tells us something about herself through the food she loves to eat and prepare. Home Cooking is a collection of food essays and recipes. It's Colwyn's first nonfiction book.
I've always wanted to not write something that was fiction, but I don't know about anything. So the only thing I know anything about is cooking. So I decided maybe I would take a bash at it, and I wrote an essay called How to Fry Chicken. And it actually seemed to just fall out of the typewriter, and I loved doing it, so I did some more.
I want you to read something from the new book. How about the first couple of paragraphs from your introduction?
Unlike some people who love to go out, I love to stay home. This may be caused by laziness, anxiety, or xenophobia, and in the days when my friends were happily traveling to Bolivia and Nepal, I was ashamed to admit that what I liked best was hanging around the house. I am probably not much fun as a traveler either. My idea of a good time abroad is to visit someone's house and hang around poking into their cupboards if they will let me. One summer I spent some time in a farmhouse on the island of Menorca. This was my idea of bliss, a vacation at home, even if it wasn't my home. I would wake up in the morning, make the coffee, and wander outside to pick apricots for breakfast. I would wander around the markets figuring out the night's dinner. In foreign countries, I am drawn into grocery shops, supermarkets, and kitchen supply houses. I explain this by reminding my friends that, as I was taught in my introduction to anthropology, it is not just the great works of mankind that make a culture. It is the daily things like what people eat and how they serve it.
You strike me as someone who comes from a good food background, and by that I mean someone who didn't grow up eating jello and tuna fish casseroles.
No, I did not. My mother is a wonderful cook. My sister is a wonderful cook. In fact, I come from a family of great eaters and very adventurous eaters, and I now realize that I say to my child the same things that were said to me. You don't have to like it, but you have to taste it, and if you don't like it, you can actually spit it out. And if you say that, you see, you can always get a kid to taste anything because of the idea that they could actually spit it out is very enticing. And as a result, my child eats a very wide variety of amazing things.
Now, is that good for you? Because that way you can cook it without your child complaining, I hate this, Mom.
No, that's not why I did it. I think it's nice to eat well. I mean, my child lives on, I mean, her lunchbox, I would say, is probably quite eccentric. I mean, she lives on 4-ounce containers of goat yogurt, which is made by this little company in Pine Plains, New York, and she really loves it. and she eats quail eggs and, I don't know. The point is, it's nice to eat well. She eats well. I don't have one of these kids who hasn't eaten a green thing in 5 years.
You make the observation in your new book that cooking for oneself reveals man at his weirdest. And I want to know if you know this from experience.
Oh, I do. Oh, yes. I mean, what I fed myself was pretty strange. But other people have... First of all, if you start thinking of people and food, for instance, the things people hate are very fascinating. And the converse of that is the things they love are very fascinating, too. For instance, I have a friend who is actually frightened of soft-boiled eggs, and another one who fears beets. And then there are people who won't eat all kinds of strange stuff. But when people are by themselves, no one's watching. They say they eat salads, but I don't believe this is true.
So what did you eat when you were living alone?
Well, I ate a lot of this peculiar kind of eggplant. I think I probably ate eggplant, if I was home 3 nights a week, I probably ate eggplant 3 nights a week. I just ate a tremendous amount of what I used to call eggplant sludge, which consisted of dark sesame oil, eggplants, hot peppers, scallions, and honey. It sounds disgusting. It's really delicious.
I think for some couples, the kitchen becomes a battleground because it's the place where you have to argue who's going to do the cooking, who's going to do the dishes, mm-hmm. what are you going to eat.
Yep.
Do you love food too much to let that happen?
I don't think that has to do with food. I think that has to do with a lot of other things. It has to do with territory, and it has to do with the sex roles that prevail in the United States of America, I think.
Oh, no, exactly. But it could end up ruining the food.
I don't actually think that actually is what happens. I think where you really get battles is when you have two people who have very different, highly developed senses of how to cook something. My husband, who says I only like cooking when it's dangerous, only knows how to cook one thing. Although if I were actually, you know, so sick I couldn't get up, I could get some poached eggs out of him, I think. But he makes the most wonderful pancakes in the entire world. They're sort of crepe-like. But most of the time, he will make a wonderful salad. He stays out of the kitchen, and we have a dishwasher.
For a while, you were preparing meals for homeless women at a shelter.
I was.
And you'd cook for about 120?
About I would say between 98 and 110, I would say.
How did you start doing that?
Well, I worked for the Coalition for the Homeless, and it occurred to me one day that I actually was never in contact with any homeless people. And I went to pick up a friend of mine who was a caseworker at the Olivieri Center, and I said, I'll pick you up early and I'll help serve lunch and then we'll go out to lunch, and I never left.
What kind of dishes did you come up with that were easy to cook and were also inexpensive that you could prepare at the shelter?
Listen, everything was inexpensive and everything was easy to cook. I mean, when you're cooking for that number of people, you don't have too much margin for fooling around. The first time I cooked alone, there was a wonderful cook there, and I was there for a couple of months, and then I went on vacation, and then I was there for another couple of months, and one day I walked in, and there was no one in the kitchen. And I said to one of the maintenance guys, where's Jean? And he said, it's her day off. And I said, who's cooking? And he said, I guess you are. And I said, how many people am I cooking for? And he said, 98. And I thought, oh, my God. I used to get nervous when I had a dinner party for 6 people. So I made my mother's old-fashioned baked spaghetti, and it was a big hit. So that was one of my staples. I made stew. I made chili. I made lentil soup. I made borscht, which was a, a really big hit. But I tried to cook a lot of vegetarian meals because they got a lot of meat, because they just did. And I remember one lady came up to me, and she said, you know, when you're making coleslaw, could you please remember that some of us don't have any teeth? So those are the sort of things that you have to remember when you're cooking for that. That specific population was the chronically homeless, mentally ill, or what I guess people call bag ladies.
I'm sure there's some shelters in which the important thing is to just get out the food, but not much care is paid to how the food tastes.
I actually don't think that's true.
Really?
Except, well, in the public shelters, that's probably true, because when I used to monitor in the public shelters, there was a lot of, you know, when you talk to the ladies about how they were being fed, there was never enough, and I remember somebody had written on the wall, murder, burgers, and suicide meat. I mean, the food was obviously disgusting, but in the private shelters, it's another thing. And when I was cooking at Olivieri, the word came out that the food at the Holy Apostles Soup Kitchen was really great, and I was so jealous. I was really, I thought, I got to go over there and see who's cooking over at Holy Apostles, and I have to find out what they're giving, because they have, apparently, they still have wonderful food.
Let's talk a little bit about your fiction. You write novels and short stories. Do you think of yourself as using food to reveal character in your fiction?
I wouldn't say that I rely on it very heavily, but, I mean, those things are details, and all details are evocative. I mean, I think it's as evocative as the sort of things people wear.
When you're writing, do you ever write in the kitchen?
Never.
Why not?
Why would I do that? My typewriter won't fit. No, I'm very disciplined about that. I have a, you know, I used to have a desk. It's been commandeered by my child, who's taken all my typewriter paper. I have no pencils. She took all my pencils. But most of the time, I just sit down at my desk and work. Although when I moved into the apartment of a normal person as opposed to a cracker box, I was very flummoxed in the beginning, because in my old apartment, since it was one tiny room about the size of this tiny studio I'm sitting in, I could sit and work and see that the water was boiling on the stove. Now I can't do that anymore, because the kitchen is an actual separate room.
Okay. Well, Laurie Colwin, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much.
Laurie Colwin's new book, Home Cooking, is published by Knopf. Here's Fanny Brice singing Cookin' Breakfast for the One I Love.
The coffee is steaming. Oh, boy, what I'm dreaming. While I'm cooking breakfast for the one I love. My baby likes bacon, and that's what I'm making. While I'm cooking breakfast for the one I love. Our life has been so nice and chummy right from the start. When a one is tummy, a one is hard. My baby is happy, no wonder I'm happy. While I'm cooking breakfast for the one I love, I'm baking a biscuit. He's wheeling to me in the kitchen while I'm cooking breakfast for the one.
This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel, co-host of All Things Considered, is joining us with a look at what's coming up. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. How are you?
What story are you following?
Well, we're following developments in both Nagorno-Karabakh, that's the predominantly Armenian region of Soviet Azerbaijan, and also in the Armenian capital of Yerevan. Armored personnel carriers reported in the streets on a day that also saw protests by nationalists in Soviet Georgia, demonstration in Yugoslavia, and, of course, a meeting between Secretary of State Shultz and the Soviet Foreign Minister Eduard Shevardnadze. Also, a report on what nations around the world have the capability to launch satellites, that story inspired by last week's, by the launch earlier this week, rather, by Israel of a satellite. And the nuclear family of the 50s, was it a feature of the Cold War?
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Dead Ringers is a disturbing new film from David Cronenberg, a director and screenwriter who specializes in unnerving his audiences. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review.
For years, in movies like The Fly and The Brood, and They Came From Within, David Cronenberg has been demonstrating his proficiency at two kinds of horror, the kind that works on your viscera and the kind that works on your mind. Cronenberg's movies have generally been so gory that a lot of people never look past the special effects to the unusually refined intelligence behind them. Dead Ringers is their chance. This extraordinary movie has no more than a few seconds of the usual Cronenberg gruesomeness, but the surgery it performs on your nerves is no less effective for that. The story is based on a pulp novel called Twins, which in turn was based on the actual case of the twin gynecologists who were found dead in their posh but hideously messy New York apartment. Cronenberg has taken the questions the case raised and turned them into the most unsettling sort of dream material. On the light side, the Mantle twins, both played by Jeremy Irons, are close and mutually supportive. They live together and they work together in their gynecological clinic. They're healers who make infertile women fertile. Being a twin is fun for these two. They share women, and sometimes their date doesn't even know that the Dr. Mantle who's making love to her tonight is not the one who did last night. As a TV actress who finds out too late, Genevieve Bugeaud is very smart and very funny.
Listen, I've been around a bit, you know, and I thought I'd seen some creepy things go on in the movie business, but I really have to say that this is the most disgusting thing that's ever happened to me.
I doubt that.
What is it with you, chum? You can't get it up unless little brother's watching.
This is a bad idea. Really stupid. I'm leaving.
Don't bother.
This is one of Bugeaud's best performances ever, and Jeremy Irons has never been as good. He delineates the twins' subtlest characteristics so acutely that we can tell the brothers apart, even when they're trying to fool Bugeaud into thinking they're one man. Unfortunately, the weak, sincere brother, Beverly, is a lot more serious about Bugeaud than the strong, cavalier brother, Elliot. And that difference, along with a lot of drugs, knocks the delicate balance of their relationship askew. Beverly begins to fall apart. And as he does, the dark, repressed material in their twinness begins bubbling to the surface. Underneath their bravado and charm, these two see themselves as Siamese twins, inseparable mutants birthed by some gynecological accident. And the dismay they feel about the things that can go wrong inside women's bodies becomes hideously entangled in their medical practice and in their lives. Like Cronenberg's masterful movie The Fly, Dead Ringers starts out bright, funny, and debonair, and then plunges us into a psychological dread so perfectly calibrated that you can feel your subconscious wrestling with it days later. Cronenberg's movies are often love stories, stories in which one of the lovers, in this case Beverly, is changing irrevocably into something no longer presentable, something shameful and terribly ashamed. Cronenberg's theme is always the same. How do you keep loving someone who's turning into someone else? And in Dead Ringers, he gives two answers. The answer Bugeaud gives, the lover's answer, is that you try to save him. The answer Elliot gives, the twin's answer, is that you change with him. Dead Ringers is a powerfully disturbing movie, and one that proves once again that in the hands of a master, the lowly horror picture can aspire to high tragedy.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair and is a contributing correspondent to West 57th. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. David Henry Hwang won a Tony Award this year for his play M. Butterfly, about a French diplomat whose Chinese mistress is really a man and a spy. On the next Fresh Air, Hwang reads from that play, and we talk about his new collaboration with Philip Glass, 1,000 Airplanes on the Roof. Also, performer-in-residence Dick Hyman performs and discusses the music of Fats Waller. And Ken Tucker has a review of several of Alfred Hitchcock's lesser-known films, now out on home video. So hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from NPR member stations and from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.